you, 44 degrees and mostly sunny here in New York City, going up to a high of 59 degrees today. Just before we move on with the rest of our programming day, I'm going to ask you to make a contribution in support of WBAI, in support of Democracy Now! That we bring to you Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. Let us hear from you right now. Call our pledge line at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You, that's right, you can sustain and help build up, help this station thrive. One in 10 of you who actually have been listening over the past hour to Democracy Now! Actually pledges. We're trying to move that needle to 2 in 10. Won't that be you? I hope it will. 212-209-2950. Covert Action Bulletin coming up next over WBAI.
Corporate Action.
Welcome to Covert Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. Our program today is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm your host, Chris Garaffa.
And I'm your host, Rachel Hu.
And we're very happy to be with you here on Covert Action Bulletin. So on today's show, we're going to be discussing the recent reporting that Google allowed unblurred images of Russian military bases, which was then corrected to not be an official Google policy change. But nonetheless, we're going to dive into the striking realities of private aerial surveillance, as well as the unmatched capacity of the U.S. government in these areas.
Then we're going to discuss what I personally, Chris, might call CNN clickbait. The recent article that came out, the polling article that came out about Biden's numbers with Gen Z. Apparently, Biden's numbers with the youth are dropping significantly. And honestly, I really don't think it's that complicated to figure out why. So I'm excited to get into all of that later. And finally, we are very happy to be joined by Tings Chak, researcher and art director of Tricontinental Institute of Social Research, as well as a member of Dongshen Collective. She is on the ground right now in Shanghai, and she's cutting through the Western media exaggeration of what is happening with the COVID lockdown there. We're going to get into all things related to COVID lockdown in Shanghai, as well as the overall COVID policies of China then. But either way, Chris, I think we should hop right into our first story here. I mean, it was rescinded and then put out and then rescinded. I don't really know exactly what's going on, but I do know that in terms of images, there were actually unblurred images of Russian military bases on Google. People found them, and Google says vehemently this is not a policy that they are actually implementing. It just seems that these images came forward nonetheless. So I'm curious what you thought when you saw it. And there's a little bit of chaos around it a little bit to begin with already.
Well, it started as many things do on Twitter when people who are doing OSINT or open source intelligence research around the war in Ukraine started looking through Google Maps to see what they could find. They were looking at spots in Ukraine, of course, but also at Russian military bases. And it's not clear exactly who started this or how, but people noticed that, yes, you can, in fact, go and Google Maps a Russian military base, just like many places around the world, and see, you know, the planes that are sitting there. You can do the same at JFK Airport, by the way. It's, you know, not anything particularly unique there. And, you know, people who are experts in this can make out what those planes are. I see some are bigger than others. I don't know much about that, but it's amazing to watch the open source intelligence community figure out that this plane is this and this plane is that. And it's really fantastic to see this, but it got a little blown out of hand, honestly. And all of a sudden there is a report in a website called Ars Technica, which covers a lot of technology and science, saying that Google had made a policy change allowing these unblurred or higher resolution images to be visible of Russian military installations. Google quickly responded. within minutes across the internet and also to Ars Technica and said it hasn't actually changed anything. Maybe in some of these cases they uploaded new images, but there's no policy change regarding the quality of the images that they're showing at any of these installations here or anywhere else. Now, it is true that if you go over, for example, you know, secret bases in the US, the quality does get significantly lower. That is something that they have worked out with the US government for national security. Other governments are able to do the same. So I actually don't think this is a matter of anything changing. I think people just got excited because they could see the planes on the ground at Russian airports. Now, I'm actually looking at a military airbase right now in the Moscow area. And it says at the bottom, if you ever go on Google Maps on your computer, you look at the bottom, it says imagery, copyright 2022. And this one says CNES Airbus Maxar Technologies. And that's where Google is getting all of this stuff from. But what we don't hear about is, of course, all of these private companies that are actually doing this work. But really what this made me think of yesterday, especially after seeing the retraction, because if Google had done this just for Russian airbases, we would be having a whole other conversation right now, Rachel. But after seeing the retraction, it just made me think about the fact that, yeah, these images, I mean, they're pretty intense and you can zoom in and you can see airplanes and you can see houses and all of that, but it has nothing on what the US government can actually do with these, you know, with this kind of technology. So when we're looking at it, right, we have the US government has a department called the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office. And I'm guaranteeing that most people have never heard of the National Reconnaissance Office. The NRO runs many, many satellite programs and surveillance programs. And the quality of these pics that, you know, Google has is nothing compared to something like the KH-11, also known, and maybe people have heard this, the Keyhole satellite. And the most recent KH-11 was launched in April of 2021, and it's the fifth generation. So this goes back to the Cold War. Scientists are estimating that the KH-11 satellite, the last generation, the fourth generation, can resolve images to around 2 inches. So maybe not enough to make out a face, but pretty much enough to make out a license plate. So imagine a satellite that we can't see from the ground. You can see from, you know, you could make out maybe a license plate. And if this sounds familiar, it's because in 2019, Trump accidentally tweeted a picture of a failed Iranian rocket launch that was taken by a KH-11 satellite. And again, that was the fourth generation that is estimated to be at about 2 inches of resolution. We are currently, I believe, on the fifth generation of KH-11s. But the NRO, this is just so interesting, right? The NRO just launched another satellite this past week. On the 17th, it launched NROL-85, which followed L-87, which was launched on February 2nd. Something really interesting about this is that these were both launched on the SpaceX Falcon 9 rockets, which are reusable. So they don't just like fall into the ocean and, you know, live there forever. They actually, this is the ones from SpaceX, which is, there's really fantastic engineering happening here. They come back down and they can be reused. And that's actually one of the few things that the NRO even says about these launches. They're like, look how cool we are. We're using reusable rockets. And of course, SpaceX is Elon Musk's private company, and they're doing all sorts of work for the NRO, for NASA, and many others. The NROL-85 is part of the NOSS program, the Naval Ocean Surveillance System, which was originally designed, get this, for doing signals intelligence work to find Soviet naval assets. So they'd put up a few of these satellites in a cluster together. It used to be three, and now they've actually gotten them down to two per cluster as of about 2001. And then they look through like signals and communications, like all the radio waves and all of that, to try to triangulate where a ship is in the vast oceans. Well, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore and hasn't in a long time. So why do they keep sending these satellites up? And by the way, the third generation NOSS satellites are codenamed Intruder, which just says exactly like what their purpose is. So I don't know, Rachel, I know I totally geek out about this stuff, but I want to hear what you've got to say.
No, totally, Chris. I think that especially it is interesting to kind of imagine, to even play it out for a moment of if this retraction didn't happen, what does it mean? I mean, I will say my little deep theory is that on some level, this could potentially be seen as, you know, really good press for Google on a certain level. Like, especially when thinking about right now that the push of these Silicon Valley companies, of these big data companies to be able to show to the US government that they can be controlled and they can, you know, heal when asked to heal. So like, I really feel like it is possible on some level that this, whether or not it was intentional, this certainly does have a good look for Google, because retractions really only mean so much when at least the initial report came out nonetheless. So that was kind of one of my interesting immediate theories on that. But if this was to be the truth, what it would mean is that in some ways, the mask of what Google is and the mask of what so much of the technology and the technological advancements we've seen in the last few decades really are. I think a lot of people don't know this history, and I got like really deep into it because I was really fascinated by it, learning more about the origins of Google and actually how so much of what we know today about everything related to data compilation, really, you know, the idea of even building potentially mass storage, like what the internet is, just to put it very simply, what the internet is in its entirety. A lot of it comes back to ultimately funding by the CIA. And the funding by the CIA actually came through a variety of different places. But in particular, they used actually this one particular organization, which was called the National Science Foundation. The National Science Foundation actually in the 90s funded Stanford University. They funded, you know, Harvard University. They funded basically all the best and bright minds of the entire country. And what they were doing was really trying to make sure that the people, the academics, the people that were engineers, the scientists, all on the cutting edge of technology during this time would be able to then go and produce the type of surveillance equipment that the CIA needed. And so it's not really about whether or not, you know, funding was given directly to Google, which it wasn't. You know, there wasn't a direct moment where a ton of money went to the founders of Google. It was really more that the founders of Google actually received grants, in particular, the MDDS grant. The MDDS grant was called the Massive Digital Data Systems Grant. And what this grant was actually made for, it was made in the early 90s, again, by the same funding, the same information I was just talking about with the National Science Foundation. In the 1990s, that money went towards this MDDS program. And what the program specifically did, the goal of the program was to develop data management technology that really was able to manage several terabytes to even petabytes of data, like just massive amounts of data. This was also about query processing, transaction management, metadata management, storage management, data integration, all the things that Google literally does. I mean, this is what made Google what it is, the ability to search for something and have it come back.
Speaking of, you know, the money that is spent on technology and science, but really in the interests of private greed, and how much money these NRO satellites cost, the military budget, you mentioned it earlier, but shock and surprise, Biden's not doing that well with young folks, with Generation Z and millennials. So basically, we're talking about people from born 1981 to 2004. Biden's approval rating is pretty much plummeting, like 20 percentage points around approximately for both of those groups. CNN says it's a shocking finding of a Gallup analysis polling.
Shocking.
I say it's like, yes, water is wet. What do you say, Rachel?
Yeah, water is wet, Chris. I mean, I don't know. Like, I just get so angry because I like, you know, anyone, frankly, who takes their head out of the sand can see that millennials and Gen Z are like profoundly disgruntled with society as it is. I mean, we're living in a time right now where we're seeing massive rollbacks unlike anything we've seen in our lifetimes, actually. Just thinking about the rollback of abortion, really the rollback of LGBTQ rights. I mean, the kind of massive right-wing attacks that are happening under the Biden administration. And also this ridiculousness of the Build Back Better plan, everything Biden really really promised. I mean, nobody is buying the fact that Joe Manchin is like, I mean, like Biden's like, oh, you know, Joe Manchin, you know, he's not with like this attitude of like, not just Joe Biden, but I mean, like all of the Democrats saying, well, Joe Manchin's really a Republican or he's not with us. He's literally in your party and he's literally in a leadership position. I think it's the energy department or whatnot he's part of. And so it's just kind of crazy to me to think that you can just say, oh no, he's really a Republican. And yet you've given him leadership roles. Cinema too. I mean, it's just, it's mind boggling to me that we live in a time where I think, frankly, there isn't a push and a pull. There isn't a tug of war. It's just the right wing completely pulling and pulling and pulling. And the Democrats, maybe they'll put their foot down to like stop the pulling for a little bit, but then they just let it keep going. Like it's not a real tug of war. It's just the right wing just absolutely decimating the Democratic Party because they have no spine to stand on whatsoever. So I just think people are not blind to that. I mean, we had all of these promises that the Build Back Better plan, it wasn't even going to address all of them, but it was going to try to address some of them. And it was just gutted to the point where what was even the point? I mean, honestly, like we have not seen in our everyday lives the kind of benefits that could have been promised, like childcare, the type of taxes, the type of tax relief that we could have really used, all types of things here, maternity leave for women. I mean, we're just like really in a current moment in time where the working class has been so profoundly under attack. And the Democratic Party has done absolutely nothing to stop those attacks in any meaningful way, not to mention student debt and the fact that Biden, with an executive order today, could pardon student debt. It could be gone. I mean, literally, the Debt Collective has a great piece on this and actually wrote up the paperwork that Biden could literally sign to have the debt go away. And yet somehow they're not, he didn't do this. And I think young people, especially millennials and Gen Z, you know, they see through the promises and the guise of what the Democrats claim. Like, you know, Gen Z actually has expectations for a future. They know that climate change is going to decimate the world we're living in. So why is Joe Biden going out there and building more pipelines and making deals with oil companies? Like what exactly is he doing for the climate in a meaningful way? Just all of the issues are not being addressed. So I really don't understand why CNN is shocked in any capacity, but that's my immediate reaction.
Oh, I mean, CNN can't get past the stage they live on, which is the two-party system, right? I mean, I'm looking, you know, as I read the Gallup poll as well as the CNN coverage of it, one of the most interesting things actually of this Gallup poll is that of the Gen Z people, 1997 to 2004, 52% of them identified as independent, not Democrat or Republican. Similarly, millennials, 1981 to 1996, 53% independent, which is higher than Gen Z or baby boomers at 45-54%. And you can see in these trends that, you know, political independence, and it doesn't mean left or right. You know, when people say I'm an independent, they just mean I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican. But the people who are moving away from the two-party system, because it goes, it's every 2 or 4 or 8 years. Rachel, I remember when Barack Obama was elected, and it was after, you know, the 8 miserable years of George W. Bush, and this charismatic figure comes onto the scene, and he gave that really, you know, riveting speech at the DNC in 2004, and everyone said, oh, this is setting this, you know, senator from Chicago up for, you know, for 2008, and there it was, because the ruling class knew that they could not have another 4 years of anything like Bush. But what did Obama end up doing? He ended up bombing more countries. Yep. He ended up jailing more whistleblowers. I mean, did not do anything remotely close to what was needed to be done to get out of the Great Recession and the financial crisis. And so then we go with 8 years, we go to Trump. And of course, that absolute disaster, of course. But we saw it, just like we saw in 2006, 2007, we saw it in 2019, 2020, the CNN types saying, well, it's got to be the Democrats, the MSNBC types. You got to look at, you know, these are the choices you have. Biden has been anointed, literally, he's the one to go to, and people aren't buying it anymore. people are saying, you promised us so much. Gen Z is saying, we just lived through like our first real president that we could remember as like adults or somewhat adults. And we survived that. We struggled through it. And you gave us Biden? Really? who can blame them? Right? Just as millennials, you know, we came of age, we had 9/11, we have the financial crisis. And then it's like, you want us to, put money away into savings accounts? Like, what money? First of all, wages haven't gone up. We have generations who are looking and seeing, like, no, it's not just that this one party or another doesn't work. It's that this entire system isn't actually working for us. And this entire system is failing us. And by labeling themselves independent, are actually proclaiming that, yeah, you know what? Not only do I disapprove of what this guy, you know, Joe Biden is doing, but I actually can't attach myself to the labels that he gives himself. And that gives me hope.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, it's kind of funny. I mean, you know, Chris, it's our fault. We're buying too much avocado toast and we won't stop buying Starbucks. That's why the Great Recession was never resolved. I mean, I literally remember, it's kind of funny. I was listening to this song the other day. It's like such a throwback. I don't want to like date myself. But song is like, there's like this lyric in the song. It's called Down. It's like 2009 hit. And it's like, you know, there's like one part that's like, oh, baby, are you down, down, down like the economy? And I was like, oh my God. Like, I just was like so blown away. Like 2009, like I was graduating high school in 2009. So as I was like graduating high school, you know, getting older, I was actually 2011, I graduated, but I was getting older and I knew that, you know, if I went to college, I'm going to be broke for the rest of my life because literally I can't afford anything. I think millennials, so many of us came of age in a time where either we just, you know, started our lives as young people or our lives had just begun and all of the rug was pulled underneath us in 2009. So many people went back home, had to live with their parents, could never get jobs. I mean, we're talking about a generation that was so defined by the fact that, you know, the issues that really just kind of in some ways dropped into our laps. It's not like things weren't bad before. They were bad before. But the particularities of the recession just never went away. Well, either way, we are going to have to leave it right there. You're listening to Covert Action Bulletin, the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. Brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more. Listening to Covert Action Bulletin, brought to you by way of WBAI Radio in New York. Covert Action Magazine has been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. So we're so happy to be joined today by Tings Chak, the researcher and art director of Tricontinental Institute of Social Research. She's also a member of the Dongsheng Collective. Welcome to the show, Tings.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
Oh, great to have you. Thanks so much.
Great so much to have you. I mean, so there's so much going on that I really want to get into today. In particular, I know what's been on a lot of people's minds because the mainstream media here in the West has been pretty much nonstop talking about it. Everywhere that you can see is about what's going on in Shanghai. There's reports in the mainstream media really talking that people are starving in mass and that there's, I've seen these videos that have been gone viral on TikTok of people, I guess, screaming out the windows. I mean, I'm very curious to know how much of this is accurate accurate, how much of this is over exaggerated, and also even then, within what is true, what is really going on and what has the response actually been? And so you're somebody who's on the ground in Shanghai. I'd love for you to share with us what's going on with you right now in this moment.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a big question because, you know, Shanghai is a city of 25 million people. It's the size of a country, really. So when you're trying to follow a zero COVID strategy and basically, you know, try to track down every single case of this virus, it means pretty big measures have to be taken. So I guess maybe I'll start with some of the facts of how the virus is, and then we can go a little bit more into detail about how it's being handled. And of course, I mean, I'm one of 25 million people in the city. I'm not going to pretend I have the comprehensive view of every single case of 25 million lives, but I've been following it quite closely. So in Shanghai, as of the last almost 2 months now, it's been one of the biggest outbreaks of the virus since it came out in Wuhan 2.5 years ago. That's for sure. So the case rates are about at 250,000 now in Shanghai since they started recording in 1st of March. And some experts say that this should grow to about 700,000 by mid-June. But I have to repeat that what's important is that 90% of the cases have been asymptomatic. And actually, yesterday was the first time there were recorded deaths directly from COVID in the 3 cases. Of course, those numbers, I mean, it puts a reminder on how important, you know, the protection of lives has been. Both 3 cases have been elders that were unvaccinated. And this takes us into another question that's really important in Shanghai, is that Shanghai is a relatively old city. You know, China is entering an aging society phase, but about almost a quarter of the population is above 60. And that is probably the most vulnerable population in terms of vaccinations. You know, just about, I've read between 50-60% of that population has had their full vaccinations. That's 2 doses. And when you look at the booster shot, that vastly decreases down to about 20%. So one of the real reasons behind, you know, ensuring sort of this lockdown measures is because there's a very vulnerable population. And I was just reading a report from the science.org about what would be the projections of Omicron, you know, which is spreading way faster than the previous strains, especially this BA2 strain. They would suspect that up to a million deaths could be seen in China in the next 3 months if, you know, the government was just to let Omicron sort of run wild and let it go. So that's something obviously that can't be acceptable in terms of, you know, what I think this country and the people have really struggled to contain for the last 2 years. And, you know, me being here in Shanghai in the last 2 years, just to get a sense, has been pretty COVID free, you know, lived a pretty normal life until this particular moment. We're kind of living a difficult situation because shutting down this 25 million person city means huge logistics problems. It is quite difficult to kind of get some essential goods. But then on the other hand, there's a variety of ways that communities are also coming together to ensure those kinds of access to services through group buying. Sort of in addition to the kind of community mobilizing, which is from the sort of government level, organized at, you know, the residential communities. And we can go into that a little bit more if you'd like.
Yeah, there's, I think, so much that I want to ask about. And I want to hear more about what you just said about the community organizing being done with and by the government, because that's something that in the U.S., like, those are two entirely separate things, you know, like, I think people here can't even imagine that. But speaking of just being in Shanghai, I don't know if you saw this, but the Washington Post had this pretty bad article called Shanghai's COVID Siege, Food Shortages, Talking Robots, Starving Animals. And that just, like, to me, it seems it just serves to scare people who are outside of the city and of China, because it tells the story of one woman who, like, has to stay home with her parents and uses, like, video calls and texting to talk to her boyfriend because of the lockdown, right? But it's ironic to me, right, that this article has this, like, futuristic dystopian portrait of Shanghai using drones to, like, send messages to people. And then they say, sometimes delivering medicine to the elderly, adding to the eerie emptiness of a city on pause. And I'm like, well, here in the U.S., they were just using drones to, like, yell at homeless people, like, in parks, not delivering medicine to anyone. Like, I would love it if I had a drone delivering medicine to me, you know, when I was on lockdown. But there also seems to be some real legitimate criticisms of the government in Shanghai and how this most recent outbreak has been, you know, managed or mismanaged. But the media coverage in the U.S., when any level of Chinese administration takes like any kind of swift and decisive action, then it's overblown. Or when there are issues, it's that they weren't prepared. It seems like China can't do anything right in the eyes of the West. So what exactly has been happening in Shanghai with the response? And what's been the result of it?
Okay, so I think that's, let me try to unpack that. I think there's quite a few things in there. First of all, I think the Shanghai situation got quite bad is there have been a series of, let's say, mistakes that the government itself actually has come out and said, in terms of probably underestimating the spread of this Omicron variant and how quickly it does. And so Shanghai, in the early, like about 2 months ago, started initiating a kind of a grid system where they would shut down specific communities if they found cases. But Omicron spreads way faster than that was able to handle. So they didn't implement a full lockdown as actually other cities had tried to do. So earlier, around I guess 2 months ago, Shenzhen, that's also a tier one city, one of these mega cities down in the south in my home province of Guangdong, implemented a very strict lockdown for 1 week and basically shut the city down quite swiftly. And I think we could say that city has kind of returned, as from what I can see, to a pretty normal stage. That's something that Shanghai didn't do and delayed quite a bit. And this allowed the virus to spread quite rapidly. In the beginning of the month, implemented sort of a two-stage lockdown where they divide the city across the river of Huangpu River and try to, you know, stagger the lockdown. So they would start with one side of the city and then start with the other. I think very quickly that four-day lockdown, and we saw that would have to be extended. And right now we're not sure how long the lockdown would extend. So I don't want to use the Shanghai case as a sort of as a way to sort of throw out the whole, you know, zero COVID policy, because one of the things is that is a national policy, but in China, there is a kind of decentralization into the cities of how it gets implemented. I think that's also one side that people don't get to see as much. So just comparing Shenzhen and Shanghai already gives us a sense that, you know, implementation looks different and effectiveness looks different. So there is that aspect. And then I also mentioned the Shanghai particularities of being a much older city. The last I checked, Shenzhen is about 5% elderly as opposed to here, 23%. So there's different considerations there as well. Back to the question of some of the dystopic or, you know, things that we might be seeing in Western media is that there has been some serious logistical challenges. You know, I was just woke up earlier today and was reading some of the numbers around the cost of freights, the cost of, you know, deliveries. And basically it's been really tricky to reestablish these routes that a lot of the private companies were responsible for from the government side. Right. I'll tell you the two levels, especially how I'm interacting and I think how most people are interacting with the response right now. So in across China, but in Shanghai specifically, communities are organized through what's called their Zhuweihui. It's the residential communities. These are sort of party structures in the grassroots areas, usually dealing with a variety of residential issues because many people live in communities that might have, you know, a few dozen building blocks, and together that residential community deals with all the kind of necessities of that community. These have really become the heart of organizing a lot of the, whether it's the information or some of the delivery of basic goods. The government has been trying to organize the food deliveries, at least some of the basic food. I would say that I've even seen in the last 3 weeks an improvement in that area. So the last 5 days, I've gotten two deliveries and, much more fresh food. There's meat, there's milk, there's eggs, there's veggies, there's tofu, which I was missing a lot, and a variety of things. But that's already seen, I've seen some improvement in my personal experience over the last 2 weeks. But we know that has been insufficient to meet the needs of everyone. And so what came together is this Tuan Go practice, which is really communities organizing group buying, bulk buying, and very much self-organized. The bigger communities were able to access sort of these bigger straight-to-vendor purchases. And now it's become quite developed, I would say, in the last few weeks. And there have been at different moments some interruptions and that kind of thing. But I would say in sort of the different listings communities I've been in, that has been the primary way of making purchases. If you get together, say, like 100 houses, or you have to buy a certain minimum of whatever orders, and you can work directly with vendors. And I think in this level, a lot of people have kind of learned to get to know their neighbors and their communities and organize in that way. One of the jokes that we have is that, you know, the leader of these, you know, we use WeChat here, which is like the social messaging platform. Like the leaders of those group buying have become sort of the heroes, you know, next to the delivery workers who have been really, you know, to avoid kind of getting locked down in their community because of, you know, new cases might surge. They've been like sleeping in their vans, like working 15-hour days, and really become the lifeline of the city. So I'm not going to pretend that there haven't been issues around accessing goods, but there has also been ways of people, you know, trying to organize in their own ways. And of course, for some people who are, you know, living in a little more precarious situations, whether migrant workers or even some students that are in housing complexes that aren't directly linked or don't have connection with this Zhu Weiwei, the, you know, Nate residential committees, there are people who are kind of struggling more. And I was talking to a friend as well in her building, and her community is how to also reach out to all the elders that aren't so much, you know, online, you know, aren't so tech savvy and in the groups, and, you know, basically doing headcounts of, okay, what about that, you know, auntie in floor four? Has anyone got some news from her? You know, so there is a lot of that also trying to be organized by the community themselves in conjunction with the Zhu Weiwei that is organizing information, food deliveries, and also the mass testing, which, as I mean, I've probably gone through 4 or 5 rounds of PCR testing in just the last week, and that's multiplied by 25 million. So that's quite an operation when you talk about the mobilization of resources and the mobilization of people.
Wow. No, that's, I mean, just saying that number kind of blows my mind a little bit, Tinks, just because I know during Omicron here in December, when it was just sweeping, I mean, everyone and their mom and their friends, everybody had Omicron. Everyone got sick. I mean, it was just mass wave of the city in New York. I mean, it was just one night and then suddenly like, bam, like there was just a wave across the city. I actually got COVID during that time. And like, I got COVID alongside pretty much everyone that I knew. Like, it was really intense. But the thing about it was, when it happened, is that there was not a test in sight. You could not get a test. And that was one of the most difficult parts of that time period, actually, in the last few months in the U.S., was just that, you know, I was waiting online in urgent care, just like begging to be able to get some sort of a test. And I got turned away at 2 different urgent cares. I finally was able to get into one of them to get a test. But the thing about it was they could only give me a rapid test. To get a PCR test, I had to drive into New York City, really like deep into the city where there's a hospital, like running a public program where they had, which wasn't very smart, like thousands of people on a line. I mean, it was just insane to see all inside of the building, even though it's supposed to be an outdoor operation, they ended up not having enough space. So just thousands and thousands of people online to get a PCR test. Everybody's coughing. If you didn't have COVID, it's likely that you got COVID from being on the line. And so, I mean, I say that to say that, like, absolutely, there are logistical challenges happening right now in Shanghai. But when you think about logistical challenges in the United States, I don't even think we're even registering it on a certain level of just how terrible things were here, just how profoundly bad it was that people in the United States could not even access testing, let alone access healthcare, let alone access any of the remedies necessary in the time being. I mean, there are tons of people here in the United States now who, because of the pandemic, lost their jobs, are food insecure, dealing with a lot of these same issues, not during a lockdown, but just dealing with them on a day-to-day basis. And for some reason, that's not being flagged as a logistical challenge, as it should be. And I really think that, to me, putting it in that perspective is very important, just how difficult things have been here in the United States. And I kind of want to say this, and I'm curious to hear from you about this more, Tings, but I think one of the things I've been very frustrated with in the mainstream media has been this kind of almost just ridiculous, consistent questioning of at what cost when it comes to lockdowns. You know, speaking of the lockdowns, I think part of what we're seeing in the mainstream media right now is fear-mongering around the fact that China's having a lockdown at all. I think we're seeing a lot of fear-mongering around that. Just look how horrific it is. How could they have people stay in their homes like this? This is just, we're over, COVID's over, basically. We're done with this. We don't need to do that anymore. How barbaric that they're doing that. I really think that's a bit of the angle. And they're saying, well, you're putting all these people in their homes, but at what cost? They're hungry. Everything's difficult. So I think that framing has been so strong in this situation that at what cost? And I want you to speak more to this because you did mention it a little bit that the fact that you can name, really just say that there's such a small number of deaths, I don't even think that registers either. I mean, just the grand scheme of how the zero COVID policies in China have led to the savings of, frankly, hundreds of thousands of lives. Like in the U.S., our COVID numbers are still steady. We are still having thousands of people die on a weekly basis. We are still having people in mass getting infected. And I guess we kind of got some at-home tests sent to us like in January. We got like 3 at-home tests sent to us. And that was it here in New York. That's what we got. And that was pretty much it. And we didn't get it again. And same thing with masks, like where people are still wearing normal, like homemade masks. They're not even wearing surgical masks. And people are also not even wearing masks at all anymore in New York, to be honest with you. No one's wearing them. The mandate is over. And so I say all this to say, like, the question of at what cost is a very real question when it comes down to the thousands of lives that were saved. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more or just kind of get to this point of really responding to that framing. At what cost? What does that really mean? When we're talking about thousands of lives being saved, what does that look like across the country in China, both in terms of lives being saved, but also the quality of people's lives for the last year? And also thinking, too, if you could speak a little bit more to the fact that there's a sense of morale. I want to talk more about the morale, but I want to hear from you first.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. One of the things I was thinking a lot about these days is that I don't think it's possible in a capitalist country in the West to make a decision such as zero COVID or to shut down a city like Shanghai, which is the financial capital of the second largest economy of the world, in the name of protecting lives. That is not in the, it's not in the game book. It's not in the realm of possibility under capitalism. And, you know, this is the at what cost, right? Because it would be too costly to a capitalist system to ever do that. And Shanghai is going to suffer. I mean, in the sense of economically, it's suffering in a variety of ways. And also in terms of, you know, socially, it is not easy to be in lockdown for any people that have gone through that. Even if, especially maybe after 2 years of normalcy and normal life and, you know, while the rest of the world was in a very difficult moment, that's also thanks to the rapid control of COVID early on in the pandemic. But I think that's one thing that helps kind of me make sense or give context to what's happening right now. And as you said, you know, I checked last week and I was quite shocked to see, you know, the weekly numbers are still above 3,000 deaths per week in the US. And this is not just in the US. I mean, Germany was almost 2,000 over the last week. And so we see this across the capitalist West and many major countries. I guess for me, at what cost is what do we think about then the cost of human life? You know, that to me is the biggest question. Sometimes I feel like I am in a parallel universe. You know, I feel like, what are we saying if we just, okay, Omicron's over, COVID's over, as the number I cited earlier, these are Western scientists predicting that it would be a million deaths in three months in China, because of course we have the absolute numbers, the big scale. What does that mean? And when you're putting the sort of individual liberties in this moment of, oh, it's inconvenient to be in my house, or there are some real difficulties, you know, some people are having difficulties accessing their regular treatment in hospitals because hospitals are now fully dealing with COVID, or there's, you know, issues around just being in confinement and that's terrible for kids, or, you know, mental health, the things that I think a lot of the world has lived, those are real. At the same time, what are we saying about but possibly protecting a million lives in 3 months or the millions of lives of over the last 2 years? But of course, I think one of the things is not, the idea is not, I mean, to have zero COVID forever. I mean, that it's not, that's not the idea at all, right? One of the things that I think China is going to have to really work on amping up, it's vaccination rates, especially for this vulnerable elderly population. I mean, that's number one priority. And in some ways, you know, I also ask myself, oh, how is it that in the last 2 years, not a larger effort was made to ensure that those rates go up higher? Perhaps it was also because life was relatively normal and there wasn't that, you know, that urgency that was felt in other places. Maybe. I mean, this is some hypotheses I've read, but it's not a kind of scientific one, let's say. But at the same time, there's new vaccines being developed. We need vaccines to be increase their efficacy. You know, there's two mRNA vaccines that are being developed here domestically, and they're going into clinical trials. So there are a variety of things that need to be done to ensure that the population is less vulnerable. But I mean, this projection, when I read about possibly 1 million deaths to just less Omicron, this wave of Omicron sort of roam wild is enough said for me in terms of at what cost. Of course, that means the government has to make huge injections of money to incentivize the economy that we've seen, you know, in the last year, in 2 years, in terms of increasing the domestic consumption, increasing production. Right now, this year, there was $2.3 trillion that was earmarked for infrastructure projects to kind of kickstart the economy. That's a huge one. I think twice what the U.S. government has put forward for the next 5 years. So this is the kind of thing. It's in the economy. It has been taking a hit, but this is at what cost, right? This is the economy sort of takes a hit for saving millions of lives. You know, perhaps that at what cost isn't such a bad thing.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point, Tings. I just wanted to say this, and Chris, I'm curious what you're thinking too, but just as you're talking, I'm just thinking about people that are in lockdown. Yes, they can't access that regular care that they can get. But on the other hand, here in the United States, you know, when we have hospitals so filled out with COVID cases, there are people dying. There are people just dying of heart attacks or things that are 100% preventable because the hospitals are just so overrun. Like, I know when I had COVID, I actually had to go to the hospital. It was really bad for me. I was at a point where, like, I just felt like I was underwater, like breathing underwater. It was terrible. And, you know, it wasn't even, that was scary on its own in a way, but what was far scarier to me was when I went to the hospital and I had nurses just in the worst state of mind say to me, well, you know, I'm just going to be real with you. Like, there's no space. I'm just telling you that right now. There's kind of no point in you being here because, like, right now we measured your oxygen. You're at 92 oxygen. You're at 90 oxygen. You're not in critical levels. You don't need oxygen right now. And at the end of the day, like, you tell me, is it that serious? And then, like, I'm just like, whoa, like, this is mind blowing. And I'm here and there's all these people in the hallways. I mean, I'm talking the hallways of the entrance of the hospital right up to the door, which is not normal for the ER at all. And all these people are actively dying in front of me. And I mean, I'm not a frontline worker in hospitals, so I can only imagine what they've been going through. But I say that to say, like, you know, the inconvenience of lockdown is in terms of just even the burden on the healthcare system, it's going to save in the long run so many more people, and the inconvenience is so much less. I mean, it's not to say it's not difficult, because it is. It was difficult when we had to do it here. It was difficult, of course, when China's had to do this in multiple places, but the outcomes ultimately are so much better. But I wanted to say this, and Chris, I'm curious your thoughts on this too, just being in the U.S. as well. Like, I think one of the things that has really struck me profoundly in what you're saying, Tings, is just that so many people came together and stood with each other and really decided that we're going to, you know, things are tough and things are not going the way we need them to go. We're going to band together as a community and we're going to serve our communities, and not just the people that we can access online, but everyone. We're going to get headcounts for everybody. I mean, that brings me so much life, because I feel like in the United States, COVID has led to, I think, this just depletion of morale. I mean, if that nurse in the hospital says anything, I mean, really, it just says just how beaten down workers are right now in the U.S. from just how much COVID has put on our backs. And I want to say that I really feel that the morale destruction of people in the U.S. when you look out, it's because we saw profit being put over our lives time and time and time again. It's very hard to maintain a sense of sanity humanity as a human being when you look out and see everywhere you turn, not a single place, not a company, not a government official, not a city cares about our lives enough at all to make sure that anything could be done properly to protect us. I mean, it really hurts the spirit. So I would love to hear more. And I'm curious, Chris, your thoughts too on this, about your insight to the morale as well, Tings, and just what, how it's so different. But I don't know. There's just, Chris, I'm curious to know from the U.S. if you feel this way too.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel that way. Back in November, I had to go to the hospital for an evening for something totally unrelated to COVID, because like we still get sick and have accidents. Like, I think people also forgot that a lot with COVID is like, I cut my finger open, right? I had to go to the hospital. And it was very similar, Rachel. It was people out in the hallway, out in the ambulance bay, just in beds waiting. And this was November, before Omicron was even a thing. And this isn't one of supposedly the best healthcare systems in the United States, Yale New Haven Hospital. And still, the nurses were completely underwater. They were just way too busy, too many patients. And it was an awful experience for everyone involved. You know, we got our government tests here, too. I'll be honest, I don't know where ours are, because they don't do well with testing for Omicron. And that's what we have. By the time we got them, that's what we had. So the experience we've gotten here, but when we did have minor lockdowns, and they were minor lockdowns, right? You know, no one was coming out to deliver groceries. No one was coming out to check on their neighbors. The only people doing that actually were community members who were not organized in any sort of government way. They had no party or state apparatus to fall back on or to get support from. And so, like, when I look at how other countries have been dealing with COVID and dealing with just like the fact that, yeah, because Tings, you're totally right. Like, being on lockdown is detrimental to like somebody's mental health. And even if you physically are surviving, that is still harmful, especially for young children, for the elderly, people who aren't using technology, but for everyone. But even looking at a system where, like, I remember in the beginning, there's that infamous video of, you know, a hospital being built in a week, right? And like, we can't do anything here in a week except shut down hospitals. So I look at that and I see it. It doesn't help the morale here, but what it does for me, and I want to hear your responses to what Rachel said too, and your thoughts on this, is that it is possible to have a system, right? To have a structure that can, you know, even in the face of this darkness, improve morale, or at least try to boost the morale of the people rather than just completely throw them under the bus.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few aspects I want to talk about. I think one is that, before getting to the morale question, is going into a little bit, I think, about the mobilization capacity, which is one of the, I think, the strengths that China has. I mean, that also links to its, obviously, its socialist history of being able to mobilize not only its local sort of, you know, people, members, but also nationally, right? So when you know, I made the example of testing 25 million people, this is the first experience probably ever in the history of humanity where, you know, you try to test 25 million people in one day. So how they organized that is actually sent the different provinces and regions, 15 of them sent medical professionals, 38,000 of them to Shanghai to help with that. And so I'll give a little experience of how it looks like for me. So usually we get a note on WeChat, or it could be a knock on the door from the volunteer that's directly linked to the Zhuhuihui. And say, okay, tomorrow you're going to be testing at this time. And then they set up these testing stations. Mine is near, right down the street. It's in the yard of a school, like a middle school. And there's about 28,000 of these stations set up across the city. And you go and basically community by community, you go out and do the whole testing of your community, and then you go back in and do the next one. The idea is that you don't want to cross-contaminate between communities, because the whole testing infrastructure is based on that. And then that is recorded into you have a little QR code, you scan, and the tests come out the next day. And I've done probably about 5 rounds of them in the last week. So that, I think you can see it's like from the grassroots level down to how it's organized with the medical staff, you know, the whole logistics of that, the testing infrastructure. Now I think the city can test about, I don't have the numbers top of my head, but they had gone to several billion tubes in a day, if I'm not mistaken, but don't trust me on that number. And then how it gets up to, you know, mobilizing of national and regional resources. And I think in terms of the question of morale, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that, you know, a 4-day lockdown, what people had prepared for, which has now turned to over 2 weeks, is not something that, you know, drains morale. Like, you know, a week ago, we could see people, you know, wearing costumes to go to their PCR testing. It became a bit of a fashion show on the street and, you know, people are having fun. 2.5 weeks down the road and without a sort of end in sight is something that affects morale. Our hope is, of course, that the kind of logistics and the kind of essential businesses can come online soon and those aspects get easier. So there is that aspect. But of course, in the Western media or in Western social media, you won't for every video you might see of someone who's really having a hard time or freaking out or having an altercation or having, you know, you're not going to see the million others that might be circulating where, you know, people are thanking their, like, you know, neighborhood volunteer for the hard work they do. I see these things every day. There's also arguments in the group being saying, hey, you didn't let us know in advance. It's confused. We don't know. We don't know how to read this official notice. It's just human. But for every, you know, negative thing, I'm telling you, there's a lot of the positive kind of morale boosting, you know, most of the groups are actually just sending memes around and just like cheering each other up, sometimes making like crude jokes about, like, I don't know. I'm not going into here, but anyways, it's also just human aspects, but that won't get any airplay in the West.
You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin. I'm your host, Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa.
Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine, brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you missed any of our episodes today, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you can find podcasts. Just go ahead and search for Covert Action Bulletin. Or you can also listen on your station's archives. So we are all out of time for today. Thanks for listening.
Hi there. For WBAI New York, I'm Linda Perry. As we move through April, I want to take a moment to thank new WBAI buddies, new BAI buddies who joined WBAI during Women's History Month. Jane Gennaro from the Upper West Side says, thanks for the beautiful programming for Women's History Month. Lucia Calamnaro is also a new buddy. She's from Boston, Massachusetts. She says, I can't choose a favorite program. You're a treasure, WBAI. So grateful you are here. Thank you also to Michelle Babian from Yonkers, a new buddy whose message is peace with the earth. Victoria from Terrytowns appreciates all WBAI shows. Jean-Louis from Long Island loves Gary Null's show. Steve Stansel from Brooklyn, New York is now a buddy at $20 a month. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Sandra Lynn, who appreciates WBAI's new morning show, What's Going On. She's a new buddy, and so is Francois from Brooklyn. Also from Brooklyn, Ben Yee is a new BAI buddy. His favorite show is from Margaret Flowers, Clearing the Fog. Ellis Landy from the Bronx says she loves WBAI. She's a new WBAI buddy, and so is Sandra from Ringwood, New Jersey. Her favorite show is Code Pink Radio. Ken from Harlem is also a new WBAI buddy. He's contributing $50 a month. He's from Harlem. His favorite show is Imhotep Gary Bird's Radio GBE, Gloria J. Brown Marshall with Law of the Land, and other shows. He says there's so many he loves. Lloyd from Brooklyn is a new WBAI buddy. Thank you so much, Lloyd. Amma from Flushing is also a new buddy. Thank you. So is Thomasina in New Jersey, and Betty Garland, who likes Vantage Point and Mansion for a Rat. Thank you. Pedro Chinnery from Suffern, New York is also a new WBAI buddy, showing the reach of WBAI. He appreciates equal rights and justice. Laurie from the Upper West Side likes building bridges. Mike from Brooklyn is a new buddy in the name of Con Sabor Latino. Brenda from Montclair, New Jersey appreciates any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Thanks also to John from Chicago, a $100 buddy. Thank you so much to all of our new WBAI buddies, our monthly contributors, large and small and small and large. We so appreciate you and your continued support. If you'd like to become a WBAI buddy, just go to our website, WBAI.org, and click Buddy, or call 212-209-2950. And remember to tell us what your favorite show is. I don't have time to list all the new buddies right here and right now, but know that we thank you. Thank you so very much for your support.
Remember, the whole reason New York City housing, NYCHA housing, was built the way it was Corbusier understood that if you did not have light coming in every window and if every room did not have air and light, people could not thrive. That was the whole reason for getting rid of the tenements that go with it.
Maureen Coates, environmental lawyer with Planet A Strategies. Hi, I'm Michael G. Haskins, host of Living for the City on WBAI 99.5 FM, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Every week, myself and senior producer Jillian Jonas take an in-depth look at the city of New York as it is developing right before our very eyes. We bring on grassroots organizations fighting to have their voices heard in how the community in which they live will grow and prosper into the future.